You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is the lecture series known as the Orthodox Nationalist, and it is still the beginning of April 2024. This is being recorded on the 7th of April, the Feast of St. Gabriel, on the old calendar. You know, when I first started, I never thought my lecturing style with no frills, no guests, nothing like that, talking about these kind of topics, would ever really be successful. And back when I was at the Voice of Reason, they sent me all the equipment, so I'd feel bad to say no. It kind of made me say yes. And it was extremely successful. And wherever I go, I'm the number one draw. I never quite understood that. Until one day, somebody told me that you are our college professor for those of us who either didn't go to college or went to college and was so badly malformed, regardless of your major, by what's out there, you are a academic corrective, which I have no problem with any of that. And I came to understand exactly what made this work. So what we do here, and the material cause of why this works, is that we deal with both the Orthodox Church, especially the Russian Orthodox Church, and political and ethnic nationalism in all of its various definitions and their juxtaposition, especially in the history of political ideas. And I deal with people, I have an education both in history and philosophy, both together. Political science kind of in the middle of these, but I'm not really I'm not a social scientist. I'm strictly in the humanities, despite everything. I have a specifically unique approach to things, because it's not merely a set of ideas, let's say from a philosopher or a movement, but it's their historical context. That's in a matter of speaking, in dialectical motion. So, and of course, as you all know, this series functions entirely on donations from my friends. And if you go to the description here, you will see the links where that can be accomplished. The great part about that is that I am free. I don't answer to anybody. Although today, actually, tonight, this does come from a listener request a few months ago. Someone had asked me to do Arthur Schopenhauer relative to Friedrich Nietzsche. Of course, I can't do that in an hour. We're going to do Arthur Schopenhauer today. I have never dealt with him here before. I don't think I've even mentioned him before. And like everything on this program, this is how intellectually a Russian Orthodox man will approach certain aspects of the reality that confronts us. And one of them is the influence of Schopenhauer, not just on philosophy, but in thought more generally. When I started grad school in August of 1993, one of the first people I, for whatever reason, got interested in, as in addition to Hegel, was his predecessor, Fichte. But that automatically means that from the very beginning, I was involved with German idealism. German idealism is a response to the mechanistic Enlightenment, especially the British Enlightenment, and to a lesser extent, the French version. And it came as a result of and a reaction to both the French Revolution, and occurred roughly around the same time as the Napoleonic Wars. And that's very important here, because the central core thing, I've always been very sympathetic to the German idealists, for, you know, this, as were the Slavophiles in Russia. Schopenhauer, a later example, he died in 1860, so he was the contemporary of Karl Marx, maybe a little bit older, born in 1788. And so he is a later manifestation of German idealism. One of the core principles, if not the core principle, coming from its founder, Immanuel Kant, is self-consciousness. German idealism focuses almost exclusively on self-consciousness as the first step in understanding not just the world around us, but in understanding the world around us, that's essentially self-knowledge. Self-consciousness resolves itself as internalizing the laws of nature, making the laws of nature part of the mind rather than something we may pick up from this external world around us. Self-consciousness is creative. It leads to an understanding of ourselves in the sense that we have a structure inherent to simply having a mind. Reflecting the structure of self-consciousness and this dialectical motion reveals the world as it is and as it's experienced from an internal but still universally held set of categories. They're not out there, they're internal. And that changed everything. That's why Kant was such a radical departure. Now, up until Hegel, that movement held that the logic of dialectics does mirror the structure of what we think is external to us, and it derives from it, and the mind is essentially a matrix between the two. Now, Immanuel Kant is not the easiest person, although I found reading him actually refreshingly easy compared with others, Fichte being one of them. But Immanuel Kant's revolution was that space and time are structures of the mind, nothing external to us. And as they juxtapose with each other, space and time creates categories like relation or quality or modality, anything like that. Since objects are inconceivable without the background of space and time, Kant concludes that it has to exist prior to experience, or at least at the same time as experience occurs, that is to say, in our minds. The categories, which derive from space and time, can be referred to judgments that go back to that foundation. They are deducible. They're objectively deducible. So, for example, under quality, you have reality, and then it's negation, and that's synthesized into limitation, or an object that we can perceive that has actual borders. You know, it's separate from things around it. And that's how that works. Arthur Schopenhauer, a rival personally to Hegel, tried to, he moved this in a very different sort of direction. A few weeks ago, we dealt with Hegel in great detail. I've dealt with him many times in the past. Schopenhauer rejects much of what we dealt with here, but he can't be ignored. The supreme principle of all things. It's comprehensible through looking at ourselves, like typical German idealist mentality. It's not your typical schema of self-consciousness and our will, but will, with a capital W, is an aimless, irrational impulse. It undergirds everything, our human instincts, and it's the foundation of all that exists or all that we think exists. This will, with capital W, is devoid of rationality, and it becomes the bedrock of everything else. It's Kant had a doctrine of the thing in itself. Ding An Sich is it's an unknowable entity that provides us with the stuff that the categories are imposed upon. So the categories are the form of things, but what comes from the, what he calls a manifold, from the thing in itself is the concept. It is unknowable, but it is a source of the stuff that our minds work on. One of the things that most, if not all, the German idealists hold in common is their rejection, that there's this unknowable entity. This isn't God by any stretch of the imagination, the thing in itself. At an absolute minimum, Schopenhauer replaces that with will, this capital W. The thing in itself is an unknowable source that causes comprehensible sensations when we apply our mind to it. That's how anything ever appears to us in a rational way or in a comprehensible way. Like Descartes, though, Schopenhauer comes to this bedrock foundation, and that is the experience of our body, of our own physical body, which is different. We experience it differently than any other thing that we may come across. And the body comes under two types, or two ways of comprehending it. The first is simply as one physical object among many other physical objects. It's a material thing, and thus it's governed by whatever scientific laws govern the rest of the physical universe. And that's what science is supposed to be worried about. But there's something else. Again, I mentioned Descartes. It is that conception, this psychological will. It's an immediate awareness that we can will this thing, this body, we can kind of move it. And it's reflective of, say, a certain emotional state or some sensation. So on the surface, these are the objective way of experiencing the body, as well as the subjective way, or the psychological way of dealing with the body. Both may well be bodily, as far as Schopenhauer is concerned, but they're experienced in two very different ways. It's not just that our bodies, you know, can be dissected by the scientific technique. There is something else. There is a subjectivity, an awareness of our existence manifest in bodily form that up until a point we can kind of use. And this is how Schopenhauer begins his famous work, The World as Will and Representation, the two-volume work, which I have. I've read it. First time I read it was probably in 1992. But let me stress something here. There isn't a causal connection between the will to do X and the doing of X. So let's use an example. He uses the example of a hand. Let's just say a hand forming into a fist. There's no chronology here. There's no objective movement from desire to the action. It's actually one and the same thing. They're two sides of the same coin, given the dual nature of the perception of our own body, which I've already mentioned. There's a subjective desire on the one hand, and the act of making the fist on the other. They are essentially the same thing, but they still do come under one of the two aspects I've mentioned already. Objective and subjective. Put differently, any action, making a fist, anything like that, is an objectification of will with a capital W. And that comes to manifest in our sensation. In this case, will takes the place of the thing in itself, the origin of all things. Now, that only goes for ourselves. Our physical and psychological presence. Everything else, you know, our soul doesn't inhabit everything else, almost everything else. They are revealed to us. We talked about in Hegel as foreign, almost obstacles. They're objective things. Something that Berdyaev, for example, in Russia took very seriously. We don't have direct access to these objects like we have, for the most part, to our own body. They're external or externalized. Our body is something entirely different. Now, individualism is an aspect of fallenness. He doesn't use that terminology. But it's an illusion. Now, our experience of our body is simply projected. It's like a template for everything else. Everything is dual, primarily because our connection with the body is dual. One physical, the other psychological. So one is interior, one is exterior. So Schopenhauer regards the world around us as one thing, having two aspects no different than our own experience of the body. Will on the one hand and representation on the other. Another word for representation would be appearance. Phenomena. That which we can perceive. And claim, at least, these things are outside of us. Different from the body in that regard. So the will, capital W, reveals objectivity. The physical unity of all things coming under some aspect of scientific law, natural law. And that's one concept. The other thing, appearance, representation, that becomes multiform. That's fragment. That automatically causes a problem. That there's no ends or purpose, at least according to him, in this manifold of sensations. Whether it's dual or not, no obvious purpose is given. But given we're constantly willing things and experiencing things, one of our first, if not our primordial feeling is frustration. This will is characterized by him as simply blind impulse with no purpose. It is a brutish concept, but it's still almost unlimited, as seen from its objective point of view. This is not God, or at least it's as far towards God as he will ever permit himself to reach. But he is, in a sense, an atheist because he holds that the universe is inherently meaningless. That really can't be easily reconciled with God's existence. But will with a capital W, the thing in itself, to the extent that these are very similar ideas, the source of all there is, and at the very maximum, it's like Spinoza's substance. It's a creative entity that doesn't have a personality. The thing in itself does not have a personality. God, of course, does. And this is part of why the world is presented to our represented to us as a matter of frustration, the will striving for everything and nothing, and going nowhere. Because we perceive the world as a multiplicity of specific individual entities that hence provoke desire, we are constantly in a state either of attraction or repulsion to everything around us. Now, Schopenhauer also claims that if that's true, then concepts of good and evil are equally meaningless because, according to him, they would be connected with purpose. And that's generally what, you know, the Platonic and Aristotelian view is, that the essence of something is the goal that it is trying to achieve. Reason, of course, with a capital R, being the goal of humanity, and ultimately resolving itself in God himself, which is something that Aristotle did not accept. But the Church, of course, completed the Platonic and Aristotelian corpus. Now, everything in this era came from and had to make reference to Immanuel Kant. I very briefly summarized the epistemology. The ethics, though, is a little different. You may have heard the phrase categorical imperative, as opposed to hypothetical imperative. It does run parallel to, you know, ontology. But the basic argument is that the form of the will, that is to say, the ability of us to will things, the highest abstraction from that, all of us willing something that ultimately resolves itself, something that can be universally legislated without contradiction, the form of the human will, both subjectively and objectively in ethics, that's consistent with freedom, since autonomy is precisely that of living the universalized form of the will as such, as a personal, but not a supernatural entity. The form of willing is the formal cause of moral right. Now, a huge difference between Fichte and Hegel on the one side and Schopenhauer on the other is that the former argued that everything is moving towards a harmonious end. And man end, the history of which he is a part, is purposive. It's infused with purpose. And that's what justifies its manifestation in the human act of willing at any given time. So Schopenhauer is trying to simplify things by saying that the world around us is the objectification of will, or the will turned manifest as phenomena. But since that doesn't provide any ends, any purposes for action, there is no ethical component. For Kant, for Berdyaev, ethical goodness can't come from cause and effect, simple material cause and effect that we assume exists around us. So Berdyaev would say that no ethical good or any good can come from the objective world. It has to be subjective. The connection between subjective and objective is the form of willing. The fact that we can, and the whole point of reason is to universalize our experience. One of the core principles here that Schopenhauer were used to reject this kind of thing is the principle of sufficient reason. And much of the literature talks about this quite a bit, as does Schopenhauer himself. That is to say, each thing, I don't care what the thing is, each thing has to be fully and completely explicated by a prior cause. It's almost an assumption, very much like the principle of contradiction. Now, this creates distinct relationships. Right? Twofold aspect of the will constitutes a psychological reality. At the same time, representation is something that might be external to us, at least we think is external to us. But there are three ontological categories here. It's surprising to note that Schopenhauer believes in the Platonic forms, or the ideas, the essences of all existing things. Now, he doesn't talk about logos, but it's very similar to it. There is will with a capital W, almost like the thing in itself, and then the Platonic forms, or the universal realities, you know, the essence of creation. And then the specific objects that we experience in time and space. Those individual objects exist in our minds. They aren't in reality. Because we are so limited, we project from these immaterial forms specific physical things. So we vulgarize everything. Will is not, you know, it's not necessarily manifest in objects. It shows itself first in these Platonic forms. These are archetypes. More general. They're not abstract. But this is what approaches universality. This is what is unity. And of course, this is not something that Kant could ever accept. The form or the archetype is far more general than what is experienced in our practical day-to-day life. There are several. But they're very much like the Logos theology. A spiritual realm represents singularity, despite the fact that there's a large number of objects out there. And they could be seen as one because they're outside of space and time. They're not individual things in the normal sense of the term. Again, this is all relative to our experience. The archetypes are not subject to the principle of sufficient reason. In fact, since we can't really grasp them entirely, they are the sufficient reason for individual things. So these forms are the direct objectification of will. This is the highest level of objectivity conceivable. The will, kind of like the thing in itself, is almost inconceivable. except as just this source of, you know, this kaleidoscope of chaotic sensations that our brain then comes to organize into something. For Kant, there are really four categories: quantity, quality, modality, whether something is possible, and relationships, including in space and time. The only thing that has its own form is us as individuals. And that has to do with our character. But what we see under the forms of space-time, and hence these categories, these dimensions, that serves as the archetype of everything else. Things like cause, things like mathematics appear from this as the sufficient reason of other things. And the will is objectified at this level. That's where the world of everyday life comes from. Now, forms don't create desires. Only specific objects do. And even though we're confronted with a million individual things, they are all referable to their relevant and appropriate form or archetype. The world of space-time is internal to us. It's a product of our own mind. Therefore, no matter what German idealist you read, our mind is constituted to project itself onto the outside world. And we do that whether we want to or not. That's no different than the beating of our own heart. Our minds are constituted to create things according to the categories that it itself possesses, the mind itself possesses. So the will for Schopenhauer is something very much like the thing in itself in Kant's metaphysics. Now, if there were no human minds, only archetypes would exist. And for us, of course, it's very similar in that our fallen state means that we don't have an intuitive connection with the archetypes. We see things in very vulgar, material, individual forms. Now, because we see the world as this chaos of particulars, despite the fact that it does have some order to it, an order that we project onto it, that's the source, though, of this constant striving in this practical world. We try to understand the world around us, and in so doing, we project individual, that is, specific and sensible objects that we create. They're strictly speaking, they're an illusion as far as representation is concerned, as far as the objective side of things is concerned. The mind trying to make sense out of the world around it objectifies some representation that derives from the form itself, deriving from the thing in itself, or the will, and converts it into this multiplicity of specific things, an array of things that we can comprehend at least at one level as a singular thing. So the individual object comes from our own very weak position, comes from the human mind as an interpretation or even a simplification of the Platonic archetype. Now, that means we are confronted with a world that is intensely fragmented. And because of that, there is no inherent purpose to will as such, this thing in itself. Because everything is so fragmented, we experience the world the way Thomas Hobbes laid it out, as one of constant struggle, where everything is striving against everything else, a zero-sum universe. If I gain, it's because someone else loses. I gain at someone's expense, and vice versa. Now, Immanuel Kant, even Hegel later, rejected this. For Kant, the form of the will is something that is unreservedly good, and it's also the principle of autonomy, because it is the form, the general aspect of willing, rather than willing something in particular. And that's what leads to a categorical imperative, something that is inherently good. That means if the form of willing is the foundation, that is universal. That leads to an equally universal imperative, the categorical imperative, that you, when you're trying to understand the moral status of an act. You have to see whether or not it can be legislated as a universal thing. So someone committing fraud, for example, can say to himself, well, what if everyone did this? What if it was permissible for everyone to do it? Well, society would probably collapse entirely because you could never trust anybody. There could be no contracts. Language would be affected. You couldn't trust anything anyone said or did if fraud was legislated as a universal law. That's a contradiction because we are social beings. We have to be. Therefore, if we do something, it's irrational because if universalized would lead to the total collapse of society, it therefore is an evil act. Schopenhauer, of course, rejects the idea of this categorical imperative. It's the will that matters, not the form of the will. He claims that the mind doesn't have any access to this form. Hence, there is no end in itself. In other words, all imperatives for Schopenhauer are hypothetical ones. Now, for Kant, it all started because he came across in the work of David Hume and the empiricists Hume's argument that a cause in and of itself is not a thing. In fact, we don't have any empirical evidence of a cause. We see something that comes before and something that comes after, but where's the cause? The cause in and of itself, separate from the objects involved, don't have objective existence. That's why Kant had to put everything into the constitution of our mind or soul. Schopenhauer's work, The World as Will and Representation, it's the mind also that creates this violent situation, this individuation, this fragmentation. And that, from that, you know, it's a blindly striving will that we can barely comprehend, the thing in itself. As far as we're concerned, the will is manifest in multiplicity, but this is a projection. But this fragmentation means constant war, a purposeless constant war. Man is a prisoner. We are prisoners of our own mental structure. But he wasn't a Christian, therefore there's no way out of it. We get to his variation of that here in a little bit. But for those of us believing that this fragmentation is the be-all and end-all of everything, which he tends to think is true, we have about as much purpose as the will itself, that is to say, zero. This is manifest in this endless desire, endless attraction, endless repulsion, which of course is the very formal cause of endless suffering. This is also where the principle of sufficient reason is to be found. Because of that, we don't have the capacity to resolve this kind of, this endless desire, this endless striving for something. So, for example, you know, Schopenhauer will say that if we attain something that we desire, there's a certain satisfaction there. If we don't attain it, it's frustration and it's painful, whereas the former is pleasurable. But the very nature of what we want at any given time is so varied, and that we are so weak as actual isolated individuals, and even if we are able to satisfy a certain desire, it goes away very quickly. The satisfaction fades away. That means existence deep down is characterized by suffering. And that's just not just for human beings, but for everything. Because in essence, everything is a manifestation of will. We suffer worse than anybody else, any other species, any other thing, because we have the ability to universalize things. We can universalize suffering. We can come up with scenarios that, you know, a dog or a cat could never come up with. We can overthink things. Our intellectual capacities make our suffering far worse, because sometimes we worry about things that could never happen. Our intellect doesn't bring any kind of relief. It actually brings pain to even greater levels of conscious awareness. So it just magnifies, so to speak, the degree to which we suffer. Because as far as Schopenhauer is concerned, the only thing that we experience directly is this blind striving for something. That's the essence of existence here. It's hence insatiable. Now, he'll go so far as to say that non-existence is probably preferable to living, but of course, you know, suicide's out of the question. He's not arguing for that. You can't resolve the problem through suicide because you don't know where you're going. The only thing that suicide would do was terminate the form of one's suffering in our body. That doesn't mean it ends entirely. That's an assumption that you can't get from the concept of death. So, but regardless, this is the origin of his, you know, infamous pessimism. Turning our will to our interior experience, and this is something even the monastics do quite often, does provide this insight. This is what some call a mystic experience. Not mystic in the stochastic sense, but to focus on the psychological rather than the phenomenal. We generate from the principle of sufficient reason this mind-dependent fragmentation, the direct understanding of our own bodies as both subject and object. And in fact, the principle of sufficient reason is based on the subject-object distinction. There's this ruthless competition when you perceive a world as completely fragmented. Everything is willing, but if everything is willing and fragmented, that's just endless war. This is the world as will that doesn't really have a purpose. Will with a capital W doesn't have one either. Now, in his earlier work, I mean, the World as Will and Representation came out in 1844. But he comes very close to saying that the thing in itself, in fact, is will. But he sometimes states that the thing in itself has more than one dimension, despite it being very close to incomprehensible. The world as will, this perpetual striving, exists at the macro level as well as our own micro level. But our micro level is reliant on the principle of sufficient reason and the subject-object distinction. It's not merely, though, that it's, you know, it's not describing reality, although it's partly that. It's how we perceive things as an embodied, that is to say, an enfleshed individual soul. Now, he can't end there. Mind does take the formal material for the things that we perceive and project as if they're external to us. What happens if we're able to perceive something that isn't individual? It would seem that if fragmentation means chaos, then unity suggests a certain level of peace. In other words, our level of frustration and pain is proportional to the degree to which we perceive the world as nominalist, as purely individuated. In other words, both liberalism and nominalism have to be rejected. This is a part of, and he doesn't use the phrase, but our fallenness, if really without our minds, only the forms would exist, only universals would exist. Hence, this fragmentation is purely the result of our weakness. That means that our perception of the world is something that we have to overcome. Simply, it's in this multiplicity where our war begins. Therefore, to the extent that something is not individual, that it is more general, more universal, it then becomes more tolerable. It becomes more peaceful. Now, what is his solution? We know what the Orthodox solution is, but without that, he finds this respite in aesthetics, in other words, works of art. He defines this as a type of a consciousness, a willing awareness, either, you know, perceiving some work of art in that the work of art is an object in non-individuated form. The point of painting something or sculpting something is to mirror an object as an ideal, not part of our world of multiplicity. When we want to paint something, we want to represent something to others, there's a reason we pick the qualities that we do. They want to capture that which the mere individual presence doesn't capture. It takes each quality in any object and raises it to its level of perfection that they're capable of. So a bowl of fruit isn't just a bowl of fruit. It's an ideal version of something that we could perceive every day that's repulsive because it rots. It has all kinds of blemishes and everything else, but not in the expression of that same bowl. We want our works of art to, even in literature, to work out. That tension eventually gets released. Hence, the perceiver, the enjoyer, me and you, become a mirror to this universal entity that confronts us in a work of art. It can transform our state of consciousness to something higher than it is in the practical world. A timeless and spaceless object of knowledge. Now, there's a lot of problems with it right off the bat. He doesn't explain how this transformation can come apart except in, you know, contemplation. But understanding, I mean, this is only for the few. How many people can appreciate art on a metaphysical level? It's only like the aesthetic master that could remain in that level of that level of consciousness. That as close as we can get to manifesting form or perceiving and understanding form or archetype is in art. That manifests the form in an accessible way. It communicates the non-individual to those of us that are trapped in our individual existence. Something outside of space and time, and hence outside of the categories that we end up perceiving as creating the state of war, the state of fragmentation. Each art form is manifesting specific objects, and we're talking about painting, sculpture in particular. Literature has a different approach, but the forms don't change. They're not part of the world of space and time. But what makes an artist is raising that which is normally perceived to the level of ideal. Now, what about music? That has its own role, and it becomes actually quite dominant in the second half of the 19th century. The connection between Nietzsche and Wagner is very musical. It's different from the other arts like, you know, sculpture and painting, that music is the highest or the most metaphysical of all art forms. It's as close to the form or the archetype that we can ever get. So a form contains the patterns that typify an object. Music comes the closest to duplicating this. He even goes so far as to break up, like, for example, the bass, he says, is you know, non-living nature. Harmony is connected to the animal kingdom, and melody is connected to our daily experience. Music then connects and mimics the structure of the entire material world to the point where it's a copy of will itself. Understanding the universe as something other than multiplicity is inherently musical. Music can achieve peace by embodying a form of an emotion, but that emotion is abstracted, that is made more universal than a particular experience of them. We watch a horror movie, no one's chasing us, but we're experiencing the same emotion in a safe way. We talked about that in the ancient Greek understanding of the theater. We can perceive an emotion and feel it without actually experiencing the danger of it. It's an emotion in a detached way. We can perceive the true objective world of forms without any negative experience. Music provides an abstract view of both objective and subjective universe. It's one of the things that evoke emotion, and the one ethical emotion that is compassion. And I also use that with a capital C. Okay. That being said, outside of those experiences, about the only other option we have is asceticism, which he does accept for the reasons we've already mentioned. Desire has to be minimized. If desire is almost inherently a matter of suffering, because even if we achieve what we want, it's never as good as we think. The satisfaction goes away. You eventually get used to it. It wears off. All of these things. So it makes sense that the number of desires has to be minimized. Empathy, compassion, that which rejects egocentrism and approaches universality. The nation, the family, connected natural objects are increasingly universal, but still with content. Anything larger than that, say a continent, is too broad for an individual to actually be a part of in any meaningful sense. Either way, our moral awareness is connected to our desire for peace and tranquility as almost the master desire. You kind of have to already understand that the fragmented world is an illusion that we, in fact, project due to our fallenness before we can even start here. And that is a connection that Schopenhauer has with asceticism. We are capable of the pain pretty much that everyone else can suffer. Which means, as I mentioned already, our pain could be a template for others, and therefore compassion, assuming you are not a sociopath and hence have a mental illness, you can understand what someone else is going through. Nominalism derived from the principle of sufficient reason. Rationalism comes down to this view of the world that it is merely a collection of these unrelated egos, all pursuing something without any invisible hand, because that's nonsense anyway. He rejects the idea of Isaac Newton, connected to Adam Smith, and that there's an order to this willing. There isn't. This fragmentation leads to some kind of concept of causality. So even science, because it has to take this as a starting point, has a painful element to it. The empirical mind is connected to nominalism. That our experience leads to the belief that everything is separate, there is no universality, that everything is just a group of alien beings trying to displace everything else. We suffer alike. We can assume, and it is, you know, it's an educated assumption, that people go through the same things as we do. One of the aspects of depression as a mental illness is delusion, that no one else understands what I'm, but that's as much of a delusion as anything else. So empathy derives not just from this cognitive assent to the forms, but also that these forms connect us, whether we use imagination or whatever it comes down to. I know what it's like to go through a horrible divorce, so when I hear someone else going through it, I feel awful because I know exactly what they're going through. We can imagine what it's like both to cause pain as well as to suffer pain. But the very fact that we're capable of that suggests that the delusion of the fragmentation of the world is just that, and we can go beyond it. It's one of the things that is, and Hegel takes this seriously in his development of the nation. Music embodies these very same problems in the world in this kind of abstract way. There's a certain piece connected there. But if that's the case, then the same is for our own moral consciousness. The nation, and you know, again, this is my addition here. It's not an accident that so many of the German idealists were nationalists too, like Fichte and Hegel and Schelling, or I should really say Johann Herder before this. It's beyond space and time, even though we experience it as a manifestation of history, as an idea. It's not just individuals hating each other. It's the foundation for cooperation, both the family and the nation. Moral consciousness derives from this. It's able to pacify the will, as several people have already said. Now, in 1839, Schopenhauer wrote a paper called his Essay on the Freedom of the Will. I found it to be a very difficult read. I think it's deceptively easy, kind of like Plato himself. And he does claim, however, that everything that occurs and has occurred has been slated and so to speak, destined to happen the way it did. That cause and effect can be found everywhere. Of course, that's something that we impose on the world around us. The principle of sufficient reason, every X, I don't care what it is, can be explained. It exists because of a series of causes prior to it. Hence the word because. Like Spinoza, things are as they are, and there's nothing you could have done about it. So there's a certain comfort in that. So there's a desire to change the world as a result of these manifestations of unity. But is there such a thing as free will? For Kant, I think, who always had one of the better understandings of it, it comes from autonomy, that no external cause forces my will to action. The universal form of the will has to be free. It's not even a material thing. He does redefine, however, what freedom means. He does say in this essay that we are aware, that we have, in fact, we're certain that we're the authors of our deeds, that there's an inherent and even inexplicable sense of responsibility for our actions, that there's a sense of determination independent of scientific law. Each of our actions is the space-time manifestation of what he calls our character, our persona, hence the concept of integrity. Our character is what could be called an act of will that's outside of space and time. It's who we essentially are. It's kind of a, for lack of a better phrase, a subjective aspect of the archetype. It would define who we are as individuals. And there's been many ways, the Myers-Briggs and ways to try to operationalize this. I kind of like the Myers-Briggs idea. It comes straight from Jung. That there's an empirical character that each one of us has, at least each rational person has. Of course, animals have it just by, that has it by nature. We don't. We have it via reason. And Nietzsche's Ecce Homo, the concept is to become what you are. In other words, what your character is what you have to strive to manifest. That's what freedom is for Schopenhauer. It's to more purely manifest what our integral character happens to be. And he really doesn't go too much further than that. But it comes down to self-knowledge, as I said in the very beginning. Neither Nietzsche nor Schopenhauer explains how we can come to the understanding of these of our character. Could it be just an idealization? Could it be worse than an idealization? Could it be just another manifestation of this cascade of events that are totally caused? Is it just another aspect of fragmentation? And neither man has an answer for that. Europe at this stage is going beyond, is rejecting Christianity en masse. The German idealist kind of gave it a new lease on life, but Schopenhauer refuses that. Our intelligible character is both a form. It's, you know, we have a personality type, but it's also subjective. It's something along the lines of a, you know, psychology is essentially musical. So any concept of agency, for lack of a better phrase, agency works, needs to be understood in terms of the will. All German idealists agree in that regard. Acts of will are bodily. Thus, our will is not the cause of such movements. There is no Kantian autonomy here. An act of will is different from everything else. It has to meet two specific criteria. It's a bodily movement that's caused by a motive, a because, and that we have to have direct awareness of it. Motives are causes that occur in as cognitive, internal causes, mental events. They arise in awareness of some motivating object, that is to say, a representation, phenomenon. Remember, there is a noumenon and a phenomenon here, just like in Kant. Now, mental events are not desires. These aren't emotions. These aren't attraction, repulsion. That's an expression of the will, not an expression of or manifestation of representation. A motive is an awareness. It's the presence of a specific object of representation, either a desire for it or repulsion against it. And it would only stand out if it's one of the two. Even abstractions still have a particular end that we provide it. Motives are really processes. They're brain processes that eventually translate into bodily motion, the making of a fist. Like everything else, it has a dual psychological and physical manifestation. The mental and the physical are not causally linked, but as I said in the beginning, two aspects of the same nature. One realm can't be explained by the other one. This restlessness, what he calls muscular irritability, this restlessness is a manifestation of this constant striving. A constant striving for anything. You have to desire something at any given moment. Inherently, it doesn't have any direction. It aims at all directions at once, wants everything and nothing. But there's nothing inherent except our character, which is just a manifestation of these desires over time. The nervous system, and again, he's talking about the anatomy of his day, does provide a certain direction. Motives act on the will. Movement is given direction, and hence the hand becomes a fist. Our anatomy is the occasion for our movement. However, all acts of will are both necessary and lawful. That is to say, completely determined. Because they're individual things, you can't get away from the principle of sufficient reason. Now, given everything that we've already said, what is he talking about? It's that our character is very complex. Our motives are far deeper than we ever at any given moment are aware of. We can be unpredictable because our character is more complex. And the more complex, the more unpredictable we may be. Despite the fact that there are personality types, we are relatively, unique. Unique can be relative. That in most things, we could be different than someone else. So we really can't predict how a motive or a set of motives can affect how we then move. In a broad sense. Now, he does go so far in that same essay to say that if we knew someone's character in great detail, we can then do a much better job at predicting their motion. Of course, for most people, they are quite predictable because they're not complex. But at the same time, they're convinced that the broken world that we live within is the only thing. Morality doesn't derive from reason, it derives from the will here. Reason for Schopenhauer is only instrumental. Compassion is pretty much the only other object that is not individual that acts on us, because compassion is inherently social. And if it's social, it's linguistic, and if it's linguistic, it's national. Most people rule or make decisions based on the rule of the ego, egotistic motives. Our knowledge of our own interests are direct. However, the knowledge of someone else's interests is indirect. They don't directly affect us, at least not inherently. So just like it's a rare person that can truly contemplate a work of art or a piece of music, it's an equally rare person that can act from compassion, compassion with a capital C. This is something that goes beyond the fragmented world that our brain creates. Compassion really doesn't have any other purpose other than giving a sense of purpose, than overcoming purposelessness. He calls it felt knowledge. So to be compassionate, to be empathetic, is an awareness that individuality, the individualness, the fragmentation of the world around us isn't real. The way we experience things is, in fact, a collective thing from the nation. But the nation already implies, and as the extended family, implies a certain level of compassion. There's something wrong with you if you don't have compassion when you see someone suffering something, especially something you know about firsthand. So your ability to feel this felt knowledge, is connected to your own personal suffering. To the extent that you can comprehend things in the world as unities rather than as specific things, you can then feel this kind of empathy with greater and greater levels of accuracy. This is the basis of his ethical system. So it isn't even so much the actions. It's not the intentions. It's their level of compassion. If you are convinced that only individuals exist, then compassion is impossible. There's no ontological warrant for it. So kind of a normal man doesn't want to cause harm to anyone else. That's okay, and that's consistent with nominalism. But the good man is different. Other people's suffering affects the person as much as his own personal suffering does. So it's not just avoiding harming people. It's the attempt to alleviate the suffering of others. Things like the nation and the family provide the foundation for exactly who are you going to feel compassion for and for what reason. It can't be everybody. It's very difficult to have compassion for starving people in the Congo versus your brother or sister. But no matter how much that's developed, whether it be the aesthetic understanding or compassion, the connection between the two, this isn't really a sustainable state of mind. It's maybe comparative tranquility. To understand things from a moral point of view is from an ethical point of view is a empathetic point of view, which is a social condition. We could be so repulsed by the nature of our fallenness, this pointlessly striving will. Now, things like liberalism and modernity are based entirely from Isaac Newton and Adam Smith on this completely purposeless movement of atoms in the void. If it's the void, then there is no purpose. There can't be any purpose. But to the extent we believe that, we're going to lose desire to feel any kind of compassion. Or compassion will get in the way. This is the reason why a sociopath does so much better in a liberal society than someone who actually may have standards. It's easy to attack someone with high standards when you yourself have no standards at all. We don't like will with a capital W. We can't worship such a thing because there is no personality in this amorphous object. But we also don't like necessarily what it creates. Resignation, renunciation, asceticism, to some extent do derive from compassion. But it's meant to approach some level of peace. Any self-conscious life is nothing but frustration. And the only way out is to minimize desire. There is a way to approach tranquility. We know what it is. Schopenhauer doesn't really have an answer. But our own sufferings, I mean, at an absolute minimum, our own dark night of the soul, so to speak, this constant struggle, we can perceive it in others. Now, how that does anything to us is another matter. Logos, of course, unifies all created things, including our own psychology. The ascetic, even in Schopenhauer's secular point of view, is this endless battle against human nature because it projects falsehood outwardly. It's the struggle against this tendency to apply what we call the principle of sufficient reason for the sake of attaining practical knowledge, day-to-day knowledge, utilitarian knowledge, for lack of a better phrase. Yeah, utilitarian works too as, you know, a practical matter, day-to-day. So this kind of conflict does derive from a delusion, the delusion of fragmentation. But when you have someone like Isaac Newton defining what the nature of the scientific is in an Anglo-American society that derives straight from that atoms in the void ideology, that's all that there is. So why are you going to sacrifice for anybody? The ascetic is meant to transcend human nature. It's meant to resolve the problem of evil by removing this desire and instead focus entirely on God's energy, which that's the one thing that Schopenhauer does not have. So there's this ascetic consciousness that Schopenhauer can't understand that is meant to return to the intuitive nature of knowledge in the Garden of Eden. To the extent that we understand that projection of fragmentation is an illusion, that these separate, unrelated individuals are in fact related to us, especially when you have, you know, objective criteria here. Understanding that seeing us as just constantly competitive individuals is an illusion, that's your first step in peace and some sense of tranquility. And that is the best I could do on the very eccentric genius of Arthur Schopenhauer. Thank you, everyone, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.